Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is our friend Ray McGovern. He used to be a CIA analyst for 27 years, and now he is a co-founder of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and he writes regularly at consortiumnews.com, Robert Perry's site, and also, of course, at raymcgovern.com. You can also follow him on Twitter at... Wait, does everybody have a L in their Twiddle handle this week or what? I think you're Raymond L. McGovern too, right? Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Scott. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. Very happy to have you on the show. And I'm very happy that you always write about the Liberty every year. June 8th is the anniversary, the 47th anniversary here, of the Israeli air assault on the USS Liberty in the Mediterranean Sea, which they got away with scot-free, to coin a phrase. So, why don't you tell us the story and why you think it's so important, and go right ahead.
Well, Scott, let me start out with a little quote from Willie Loman. These things must be remembered, especially this egregious example of the cowardice on the part of our top naval officials in this instance, where they went along with a cover-up under which the Israelis, who killed 34 seamen, wounded over 170 47 years ago on June 8, 1967, were let off scot-free, to coin a phrase. There was no reputable investigation. The crew themselves were sworn to secrecy under penalty of court-martial. Now, imagine. You're attacked in this brutal attack. You come up out of the hole that was made by the torpedo after trying to salvage as many body parts as you could from the 27 people killed there. And then you come and you're visited by high-ranking naval officers in Greece who tell you, you must not breathe a word about what happened to your wife, even to your fellow crew members, under pain of court-martial. Now, that obtained for about 30 years or so, and you want to have a clinical description of what's necessary to cause PTSD? Well, there it is. I've been friends with some of these crew members for a while. They all went through it, and small wonder when you can't even discuss what happened with your own crewmates. Now they can. Now they're a little bit older, old as me, some of them. And every year they congregate here in Washington to commemorate the anniversary, June 8th. Yesterday was no exception down at the Navy Memorial. We met there. We reminisced. We had a ceremony where we read out the names of the 34 who were killed. And we stayed in wonderment that top naval officials and our captivated mass media still won't tell the truth about that attack. And the truth involves two main aspects. One, that it was deliberate, and there's no question about that. We have intercepts which indicate that the Israelis told their pilots and their PT boat commanders to shoot at the American ship, the USS Liberty, even though it was fully identified as an American ship. So that it was deliberate is not in doubt. That it was covered up, that too is not in doubt. I'll give you a small example for that. A naval communications specialist, then in Morocco at a relay station, listened in on the conversation between Secretary of Defense McNamara at the time and Admiral Geis, who was head of the 6th Fleet. Now, Admiral Geis had gotten an SOS from the Liberty, and we can talk a little bit more about that, how that happened. And he learned that one of the ships in his fleet was under attack. First reaction, send off the fighter bombers from the USS Saratoga, the USS America, to do battle with whoever it is that's attacking this ship under Geis's command. Halfway there, Geis gets this call from Secretary McNamara in Washington. How do we know that? Once again, this naval official in Morocco was listening in. And this is how the conversation went. You must recall those fighter bombers immediately. Have them make a U-turn back to the ship. Geis.
You're saying that those are the exact words of Secretary McNamara.
I'm saying that, I'm saying that this is how it came out from this transcript, which is, all right, the name of the chief petty officer in Morocco is Tony Hort, and he monitored the conversations from a U.S. Navy communications relay station in Morocco. And when McNamara said, have those warplanes return immediately to their carriers, this is what Geis shot back. One of my ships is under attack. Response from McNamara, quote, President Johnson is not going to go to war or embarrass an American ally over a few sailors, period, end quote. Now, Geis, I suppose because he's a, well, he obeyed the order, and they were taken back to the planes went back to the carriers. We have stories from those pilots from the America and from the USS Saratoga as to how they felt about all this. What no one knew at the time was this, that even though the Israelis had shot up all the active radar on the USS Liberty, and there was lots of radar on that ship, they neglected to shoot up one one communications link that was not connected. There had been some trouble with it. There had been some need for maintenance. So they did that didn't appear live on their screens. Now, Terry Halbardizier, a 23-year-old Texan seaman, was on deck, and he said to the skipper, he said, look, you know, there's one communications link that I think I can get reestablished. I just need to get this cable to it. Permission requested to slide across this napalm-filled deck so I can make this connection. McGonagall, the commander, said, well, if you think you can do it, go to it. Terry Halbardier did do that, connected the cable, and an SOS immediately went out to anybody who could hear it in the area, including, of course, the Israelis who were attacking the ship. Now, the Israelis, we know from other intercepted messages, said, oh, bummer, we better get out of Dodge. And so the patrol boats, the torpedo boats, and the planes went back to base right quick. Okay?
Yeah, little could they imagine that the President of the United States would call back the fighters that were being sent to protect his own ship.
Yeah, isn't it a little ironic that they need not to have been worried about it?
God dang.
God. So the rest of the story is that because of the bravery, you know, and the ingenuity of this 23-year-old seaman from Texas who simply connected this cable, what happened was not the whole crew got killed.
The ship was not sunk. 84. They failed in their mission. Now, we have to hold it right there, but we're spending the whole hour here with Ray McGovern, everybody, so don't go away. It's Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for sanity. You can read him today at antiwar.com and at consortiumnews.com about the USS Liberty, leaving the USS Liberty crew behind. Back in just a sec. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Ray McGovern. He's a great American peace activist, really is. and co-founder of the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Here he's writing at consortiumnews.com and also reprinted at antiwar.com, leaving the USS Liberty crew behind. And so far, Ray's told the story of the Israeli air attack on the USS Liberty on June 8th. Yesterday was the anniversary, June 8th, 1967, and the heroics of a young Texan who connected the antenna to call for help. The absolute treason, my word for it, on the part of Lyndon Baines Johnson and Robert McNamara in calling back the fighter jets who were being scrambled to help and attempting to abandon those men to their fate, even though the signal out was enough to scare the Israelis off. That's where we left off in the interview. But now, so I have to ask you this part, and there's so much to cover here, Ray, but where were you that day, and what do you know about it professionally from your own experience in the U.S. government?
Well, I was working as an analyst at CIA headquarters at the time, and of course, I was in touch with people who were monitoring this in the Middle East branch, and I remember it was very clear to them that the Israelis did this deliberately. It was very clear to the people at NSA who had the intercepted messages. There wasn't a person who believed that anything other than a deliberate Israeli attack had occurred. Now, why the Israelis did this is another question. One would think that since we have the intercepted messages showing that it was very deliberate, one would think that someone would take those intercepted messages to Tel Aviv and talk to the heads of the Israeli government and say, all right, 47 years have gone by. Tell us why you shot up our seamen. Tell us why you tried to sink our ship. But you know what? For some strange reason I can't understand, Scott, nobody will do that. Instead, the U.S. government and the U.S. Navy, for God's sake, and that's what really hurts. So when I was an Army officer, we were told that our first duty was to protect, to defend, supervise our men, to act as their advocate. How can you explain the cowardice of the naval leadership at that point and Admiral John McCain, whose celebrated son is now a senator, who was told by Lyndon Johnson, look, we need to do some sort of inquiry here, but make sure you do it within a week. Don't send anybody to Israel or anywhere else to ask questions. We're sure it was just a very terrible mistake, just like the Israelis said. Finish it off and we'll put this behind us. And what did Admiral John McCain do? Well, he saluted smartly and betrayed his men. Betrayal is the word here. I don't use treason. That's very, very distinctly defined in our Constitution. But it was a cowardly betrayal of our men. And now you will not get anyone to pick up the pieces here. There was a separate inquiry 11 years ago by an independent panel on which sat former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Thomas Moore, and other high dignitaries with experience in military affairs. And they determined that the attack was deliberate, that it was covered up by high-level officials, and everybody yawned, and nobody would give it any publicity. Someone wrote in the comments section of one of the places where my article appeared yesterday, and they said, my goodness, McGovern has done something that nobody else will do, hardly even on the blogosphere. He's called it like he sees it. Well, why should that be so extraordinary, Scott? I just don't understand. Where are people's guts? Why don't people brace what happened? Why don't people defend these folks? It reminds me of what's happened now to our veterans. We know that it's been just another betrayal. Who cares about our veterans? They're only, as LBJ put it, just a couple of sailors. Who's going to go to bat for just a couple of sailors? Well, 34 is not just a couple. And 174 is also not just a couple. That was two-thirds between the killed and wounded two-thirds of the crew of the USS Liberty performing intelligence operations in international waters on a bright, sunny afternoon with the U.S. flag flying high. We know the U.S. flag was flying high because the Israeli pilot said, but that's a U.S. ship. That's a U.S. ship. Follow your orders. Hit it, is the response they got. It's all in the intercept.
Right. Well, you're going to hate this, but you already know. The answer to your question is that it doesn't fit the narrative. And even if it's just a matter of fact, it doesn't seem to fit with what everybody would prefer to believe about the relationship, not everybody, but the people with power in America and the American political class, about the relationship between our country and theirs. And after all, as you say yourself, we don't know for certain what their motive was. We've talked before about this, where it could have been covering up war crimes in the Sinai or moving on the Golan or whatever it was that they thought might be a problem. Or I forget if you had other theories that people have put forward. But that makes a great talking point for the deniers, too, at least to even just tell themselves while they dismiss it. But why would Israel do such a thing? It just couldn't be that that's the real story there. And then so why trouble themselves with a troubling story that just doesn't sound right? Why in the hell, Ray, would Israel attack the U.S.?
Well, there were several good reasons. Remember, this was right in the middle of the Six-Day War in the Middle East in June 1967. The Israelis had already decimated the aircraft in Jordan and in Egypt and in Syria. They had already broadened their territory by many factors, and they weren't finished. They fully intended to occupy the Golan Heights, which overlook that part of Syria. I've been there. I've seen the Golan Heights. They are very commanding, okay? Now, we're talking about June 8th. The Israelis had already successfully invaded the Sinai, given the bloody nose to the Egyptians. And next day, they planned to go up on the Golan Heights. Now, you couldn't go on the Golan Heights without telling your forces, giving them orders and telling them how to dispose and all that kind of thing. And you couldn't do that without the kinds of communications that the Israelis knew the USS Liberty was fully equipped to intercept and send right back to Washington. So one theory is that the Israelis are very much in favor of not asking for permission, but rather asking for forgiveness after the fact,
yeah,
didn't want the U.S. ambassador descending on them in Tel Aviv and saying, we know you're going out of Golan. Don't do it.
Well, I have no idea why the board just dumped your audio so far down when the music kicked in, Ray. That wasn't fair. But anyway, we got to take this break, but we still have half of this interview to go. So hang tight, everybody. It's the great Ray McGovern, veteran intelligence professional for sanity. Read his new article about the Liberty today at antiwar.com. It's the picture story there. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now peacenik, veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, writer for ConsortiumNews.com. The piece today, it's the picture story there on the front page of antiwar.com, leaving the USS Liberty crew behind. And when we were interrupted by the break last, Ray, you were talking about the possible motives, the most likely motives for the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, which was, again, a national security electronic intelligence ship. And so you're talking about the Golan Heights there, I believe, when we were interrupted.
Right. Scott, the other very reputable theory, and one that James Bamford, the par excellence expert on NSA, advances, and he does this in his excellent book, Body of Secrets, mm-hmm. He says that Israeli journalists were eyewitnesses to some pretty terrible things at Al-Arish, which is right on the coast there in the Sinai. What had happened was the Israelis had taken many Egyptian prisoners as they came through the Sinai on three axes, and the one that was the most western ended up with about 200 or 300 prisoners. Now, Egyptian prisoners in the Sinai in the desert, you know, that's a terrible bother. You have to feed them, you have to give them water, most important. And it was just sort of a real encumbrance on the Israelis who were preparing to go up on the Golan against Syria. And so what happened was, according to these eyewitness Israeli journalists, is that the Egyptian captives, many of them officers, were ordered to dig their own graves. They were shot, and they were buried right there in Al-Arish. And then they looked up, and they saw this ship. It was 13 nautical miles off Al-Arish. That's in international waters. And I'm sure you hear the Israeli commander, they say, oh, bummer. Ugh, bummer. Because the Liberty had all kinds of capabilities, but certainly it had line-of-sight capability to pick up these kinds of communications and find out what was going on there. So that's how Jim Bamford comes down, and it's a very reputable theory. The point is, we can find out. All we have to do is summon the courage, the guts. We don't even have to have any chutzpah. We just say, hey, Israel, why'd you do this? And why have you covered it up? And why has the rest of the United States covered it up? You know, I'm thinking, Scott, that...
Well, you know, wait a minute now. Tell me what you're thinking in a sec, but I was going to say that one of the subjects that you and I have talked about over the years is America's Iran policy, and something that you highlighted numerous times as being very important was it Admiral Blair bringing up the USS Liberty in the context of Iran in... It seemed like what he was saying to the Israelis is, you better not attack us to try to make it look like the Iranians did it, because I'm going to know and I'm going to be pissed off at you, and it's not going to work, so don't even try it. That happened just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
So that would be the one instance where the Americans brought it up to the Israelis at all, and it was, don't you do that again.
That's right. It was Mike Mullen, actually.
Mullen, that's right.
At the time. It was July 2008. It looked very much like Netanyahu and the rest of them were hell-bent on starting a war with Iran, whether by provocation or in some other way. And so Mullen was sent out there to talk to his opposite numbers and the defense minister in Tel Aviv and say, look, you know, you better not do this. We're not going to be automatically supporting you if you attack Iran. And he pulled out this ace in the hole. He referred, for the first time that I know of any senior American official referring to, he said, look, we know what happened at the Liberty. We remember that. Don't you ever try to do that again to one of our naval vessels. Don't monkey around like this again. And that brought him up short. Now, there were a lot of reasons why the Israelis backed off, but that was the only time that I saw a high-level military official faced them down on that. And to his credit, he was a naval officer, Admiral Mullen, and he was not the worst by far of our Joint Chiefs of Staff. One thing I'd like to do is, well, two things really. Mm-hmm. I got most interested in the Liberty at a very, very curious juncture. It was about 7 years ago, and I was giving a talk down in Springfield, Missouri. And on the way down, I printed out the London Review of Books version of Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer's piece on the Israel lobby. Mm-hmm. This was the one that was commissioned by the Atlantic magazine, And when they saw the draft day, they held their noses and said, guys, you don't expect us to publish this. Suffice it to say that Mearsheimer and Wall could not find a U.S. publisher for this. They had to go to the London Review of Books. And it was, of course, a factual explanation of how powerful the Israel lobby is in this country. Witness how they've been able to suppress this story about the Liberty. Now, what's the point of this? Well, I'm speaking at a big church hall, about 300 people, and somebody says, hey, what do you think about the Mearsheimer Waltz piece? And I said, thank you. You know, I had just read it on the plane. I said, well, actually, I just read that on a plane. I think it's great, but you know, what I don't understand is why they avoided mentioning the most egregious example of the power of the Israel lobby. And I saw nobody's catching eyes. I mean the USS Liberty. Now, there are 300 people there, Scott. And it was the blank expressions on 297 of them, okay? Because I asked, you know, how many people have heard of the USS Liberty? Three hands go up. So I call on the guy who's in about the third row. I said, sir, can you tell us how you learned? He stands up, ramrod straight, and he says, Sergeant Bryce, Sergeant Bryce Lockwood, U.S. Marine Corps, sir, member, USS Liberty crew, sir.
That was one-third of the people who knew what you were talking about.
Yeah, right.
A survivor.
So I said, Bryce, Sergeant Lockwood, would you share with us, could you come up just for 5 minutes and tell us what happened? And it was amazing. He stood ramrod straight and he said, sir, I have not been able to do that yet, but it's been 40 years now, sir. I'd like to try to do that tonight. And he marched up to the podium, and for the next 10 minutes, he gave a graphic description of how, by happenstance, he was behind the bulwark with the sensitive communications and spying equipment that he was just about to drop over into the bottom of the Mediterranean. The torpedo hit, killing 26 of his men in the NSA. He was a Russian linguist, but there were many Arab linguists there and two Israeli linguists. 26 killed. Next thing he found himself doing was trying to salvage one or two of them that seemed to be still alive before they floated out through the hole that the torpedo created. He recounted that story. And it just, you know, was so authentic and so gripping. And then he said, I've not been able to talk about that till now. And I guess I'm still violating the rule. And if they court-martial me, I hope the other 299 of you will come to my rescue. Now, Scott, Bryce Lockwood was there yesterday afternoon at the Naval Memorial in Washington with about seven other USS Liberty survivors. There was a ceremony I participated. I can tell you that never have I.
I'm sorry. There was a ceremony. What, Ray?
I took part in the ceremony. Mm-hmm. They read the names of the 34 who were killed. The grief was thick, and I just got so angry that I had to make sure that everybody that I knew didn't have a chance.
All right, well, Ray, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I don't know why when the music comes up, it pushes your level so far down like that. That's crazy as hell. But anyway, we'll be right back. We got one more segment with the great Ray McGovern on the USS Liberty right after this, y'all. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. Welcome back to it. I'm on the line with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, now veteran intelligence professional for Sanity, and writer for ConsortiumNews.com, RayMcGovern.com, AntiWar.com. The piece today is Leaving the USS Liberty Crew Behind, and I want to recommend to you guys, if you just search ScottHorton.org, for USS Liberty, you will find interviews with Joe Metters and Ron Kukol, both survivors of the USS Liberty. And I think probably there's a couple of previous interviews of Ray. I'm not sure if I ever interviewed James Bamford about the Liberty or not. But anyway, if you search the archives at scotthorton.org, you can find interviews with at least two different survivors of this attack. And one of the things that I'm not sure if we had a chance to talk about, Ray, but I wanted to make sure that we do talk about, is how they strafed the lifeboats and the stretchers. And they really were attempting to... apparently, there's no question about it. This was from I believe you write here, that Admiral Maurer's investigation determined that they were trying to make sure to kill each and every last person. No survivors, no witnesses.
Well, that's right. And those are war crimes, pure and simple. You don't do that. It's against the law of war. It's against all manner of conventions. Now, I'd like to just say a word about our four-star generals. You just mentioned Admiral Maurer. He had the guts to pursue this independent investigation, came up with their results. It was totally ignored in the press. Now, Maurer is an exception to the rule. He cared about the troops. I'm just reading a headline here. The Veterans Administration says more than 57,000 patients are waiting for their first visit. Now, there's a very, very serious deficiency in leadership in this country, and nowhere is it more evident than with the four-star generals. And I'd like to just tick off a couple of things, because I am, frankly, very ticked off at what's been going on.
And Mullen, you're a former military veteran as well, aren't you, Ray?
Yeah, I was an Army officer, and right. It pains me greatly to see what's going on. We mentioned Admiral Mullen. He was not the worst, okay? He did that gutsy thing in July 08, mentioning the Liberty incident to the Israelis. And yet as soon as Chelsea Manning released those reports, Mullen was among the first to say, oh, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, this be irreparable damage. So they fall in line, okay? Now, nowhere has the falling in line been more evident than one of these sainted generals, General four-star Tony Zinni of the Marine Corps. What about him? Well, he was at the Veterans Foreign Wars meeting on the 26th of August, 2002, when Dick Cheney got up and said, Saddam Hussein has all manner of chemical and biological weapons, and he's preparing a nuclear weapon. He's very close to it. UN inspectors, they're not worth a darn. They just give you a false sense of security. We got to zap them. Now, Zinni said 3 years later, I say again, 3 years later, you know, I was sitting there. I was getting an award at this ceremony, and I was listening to that, and I was still on contract with the U.S. government. I just retired, but I knew that the intelligence didn't support what Dick Cheney was saying. And what did Tony Zinni do? Well, he played Brer Rabbit. He didn't say nothing, okay? Next one, Eikenberry. Carl Eikenberry was commander of forces in Afghanistan. Before that, he supervised the training of Afghan troops. And when the Zionists, led by Bruce Rydell of the Sabin Institute at Brookings, and General Petraeus and the others decided, well, they'd mousetrap Obama into sending more troops to Afghanistan, two surges, one in March and one later in the year of 2009. Mm-hmm. What did Eikenberry do? Well, he wrote these two incredibly good cables, one of them saying, look, this is a fool's errand. Karzai is not a reliable partner. These guys will never get trained up. And besides, if you don't close off the border with Pakistan, it's not going to work. And what happened? Well, he was overruled by the neocons, by Petraeus, and by that little group that Obama assembled. Mm-hmm. And what did he do? Well, he played like Brer Rabbit. He didn't say nothing. Worse than that, he went up on the hill and he advocated for this stupid plan that cost us another 1,000 U.S. servicemen's lives at the second surge of that kind. Okay, so there's Eikenberry. What about Petraeus? Petraeus was sent out by Dick Cheney in May of 2004, right after right after Abu Ghraib. That was April, okay? April 2004, Abu Ghraib disclosures. May, the only decent, the only honest investigation done by General Taguba of the Army. And in June, what happens? Well, Rumsfeld sends Petraeus out to Iraq with new orders, okay? Frago 242, for those of you who don't know what Frago is, it's a fragmentary order, okay? Mm-hmm. We know about that from Chelsea Manning. What did Frago 242 say? It said, look, we should not torture anybody anymore, but if you see Iraqis torturing one another, you might want to report it, but you don't have to. Now, I'm talking June 2004. One of the things that Chelsea Manning saw in Baghdad on the ground was what was happening to people his age being thrown into Iraqi prisons and being tortured. That's one of the things, one personal experience with innocent suffering that made an impression on him. Okay, so what happened?
He was even actually ordered to participate and had warned her superior officers, hey, this guy is guilty of nothing but writing a critical essay for the local newspaper. And
that's
they
right.
said, the commanding officer said, yeah, and get back to it, too.
Yeah.
And that
okay.
was the real line that was crossed, where
right.
Chelsea Manning decided, well, something's got to be done then, because if I'm going to be forced to participate in the torture of some innocent guy, I'm going to stick up for what's right in another way.
That's right. And, you know, unless you have that personal experience with innocent suffering, I mean, that's the real catalyst, if you have a conscience. And Bradley, Chelsea Manning, thank God, had a conscience. So it was not the collateral murder video. That came later. I mean, that was sort of icing on the cake in some sort of dark way. But it was his experience there in Baghdad. So what's happening? Petraeus is supervising all this, okay? You don't have to worry about the Iraqis torturing each other. As a matter of fact, as long as it's Sunni that's being tortured, so much the better. And you can see what's happening today. What's my point? Well, that was June 2004. In November 2005, so we're talking a year and a half later, it became clear to some of the U.S. journalists in Baghdad that this was going on. A woman reporter asks then General Pace, who is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Marine general, pretty straight guy, okay? Rumsfeld and he are having this press conference. The journalist says, General Pace, what are your instructions if your armed forces see people being tortured by these Iraqis? Pace, without blinking an eye, my instructions are to stop the torture on the spot. Stop it with every piece of power that you have to get it stopped. Rumsfeld, oh, I don't think you mean stop it, General. You mean you might want to report it. Pace, no, sir, that's wrong. My orders are to stop it. Now, why do I point that out? That was the most bizarre exchange between a subordinate, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, who didn't last very long,
right.
and his superior.
Yeah, I remember when it happened, too, and he says those are the laws of war. And in other words, he is in the position of authority to say what the laws of war are, even if the Secretary of Defense disagrees with him. He doesn't
have
to just go along with that.
So what did that mean? That meant that Frago 242 had been deliberately kept from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Rumsfeld and Petraeus were running this thing together. Now, that's pretty bad. Now, let me give you some good news. There's one general who's head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff right now. His name is Dempsey, Martin Dempsey, who has a conscience, who has successfully prevented another stupid war in the Middle East. And very briefly, when Secretary Kerry got up on August 30th at the State Department, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and said, we know Bashar al-Assad is responsible for those chemical attacks on August 21st. We know. He said it 35 times, all right?
Now, hold on one second, Ray. Let me say bye to the people. I got to keep recording you after the top of the hour here, obviously. But thanks, everybody, very much for listening. We'll be back here live from noon to 3 Eastern time tomorrow here on Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM. And now, Ray, please continue, and we'll just go on for as long as we need.
Sure. Well, what happened there is something that Americans need to know. John Kerry was not telling the truth. He didn't know who did those chemical attacks. Nobody knew at the time, but my former colleagues in the CIA knew that the evidence was very ambiguous, and they told us. They told us, veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity said, look, guys, we're not going to do another Iraq. We're not going to falsify the evidence to justify, in quotes, another war. And besides, there's no such thing as an unbelievably short war in the Middle East like John Kerry apparently thinks. So we told everybody who would listen, and so did General Dempsey. General Dempsey was in receipt of information from the British, his British counterparts, who had been given a sample of the sarin used in those attacks on August 21st, and the British had already determined that it was not the kind of sarin that was in Syrian army stocks. It was a different kind of rudimentary sarin that we knew, that Western intelligence knew, the rebels were capable of producing and had already indeed produced. So here you have Kerry 35 times saying, they crossed the red line, we know, they're doing all this stuff. Now, what does Dempsey do? Well, I don't know if it was that Friday night, August 30th, or whether it was Saturday morning, August 31st, but he goes to the president and he says, Mr. President, look, despite what your Secretary of State is saying, we don't know, okay? We have reason to believe it was the rebels that did this, but more important, Mr. President, it's not going to wash this time because the truth is going to come out. And by the way, you know, we know you really like those tough guys in the White House and those tough women now that you got around. But Mr. President, with all due respect, they don't know diddly about war. We do. Okay, we do. Not only that, but John Kerry, you know, hats off to him for sailing boats up the Mekong, but that doesn't make you a strategic thinker. And he knows that we know that he's not telling the truth. So, Mr. President, if you go ahead now and approve this war that Kerry really wants you to do, you know, what's going to happen is I'm going to be besieged by the press here in this country. They're going to say, General Dempsey, why is it you could not have waited 2 days to hear the report from the UN inspectors coming back from Damascus on what really happened on August 21st? And Mr. President, you know, it's going to be kind of difficult, but I'm going to have to say to them, beats the hell out of me, go ask the president. All right? Now, Dempsey said, look, Mr. President, here's what you say. Our ships are in position. We have four cruise missile capable ships in the Eastern Med, and we can zap the Syrian inventory of chemical weapons, but we don't need to do it today or tomorrow or next week or next month. We can do it at our leisure. And by the way, Mr. President, I think you ought to also say that you're going to go to Congress to seek appropriate authorization, because I've testified on that, and I think I may have to quit if you don't do that. Okay. Now, what's the proof in the pudding? I'm outside the White House, okay, on the 31st of August, Saturday morning, noon. We have this big demonstration going. We have somebody inside where the Rose Garden appearance of the president is just about to happen, and we get word the president has just said, our positions, our ships are in position, Eastern Med, but we don't have to do this today or tomorrow or the next. And he says, quote, there is no time sensitivity to this, and I'm going to seek congressional authorization. We couldn't believe our ears. So he blamed it on Dempsey, and the proof was in the pudding. Next day, Sunday now, the 1st of September, John McCain and that fellow Lindsey Graham, they descend on the White House in high dudgeon. They're so angry. And they come out into the parking lot there, and the film, the cameras are going, and they say, that Chairman Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, he doesn't know what he's talking about. This was going to be a war that needed to be. It could have been an unbelievably short war, you know, blah, 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 okay? So there's the proof in the pudding. What happened was Dempsey stood up to the president and said, look, we have this other channel going. We're working with the Russians, actually, to get those chemical weapons out of there. President Putin and President Obama went around behind the back of Kerry, came to an agreement, and the Russians bailed us out on that by getting the Syrians to destroy all their nuclear weapons, all their chemical weapons. Who would have thought that was possible? Now, final thing here, you want to know why people like John Kerry and Naocon Victoria Nuland, a neocon, why they hate Vladimir Putin with the fervor with which they hate him? Well, I grew up in New York, right? Gene Autry, we used to do these cowboy films, and the Iroquois Indians really hated Gene Autry. Well, the next film that would come out, the commentator would say, you remember how much they hate Gene Autry. They hate him yet from another picture, right? Okay, well, Nuland, Kerry, and the other neocons hated Putin from this other picture where they almost had their war in Syria. And that's part and parcel of why they ginned up this coup d'etat in Kiev, and whether they thought they could ever succeed in weaning Ukraine into NATO, that's an open question. But they knew damn well, pardon my French, that they could cause real poison in the relationship between Putin and Obama. And indeed, they have succeeded beyond all expectations in that. And I am seriously concerned right now that the Russians might be provoked into intervening in the Ukraine because this new president his speech and his actions indicate that he's wanting to provoke them to come in. I just hope that that Putin maintains his sang-froid and is willing to hold off and not be provoked into military intervention, but rather use the economic and other cudgels that he has to prevail, because this is where he holds the high cards. He doesn't need to invade. I just fear that the pressure is on him. The more and more people get killed in the eastern part of Ukraine, that he may feel that he has no other option.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and now that could be a whole other interview, or we could get back to it. It's fine with me if you want to get back to it and continue on. But to get back to tie this all back to Israel again and our original topic of the USS Liberty here, like you're mentioning about, you know, the motivation of the neocons to prevent any kind of, to whatever degree they can, to obstruct the relationship between the United States and Russia in cooperating on issues like Syria and Iran. And why Syria in the first place? America's policy on Syria in the first place? Partly Saudi, but mostly because that's what Israel wants, to help weaken Iran. And I actually should go ahead and make a correction here, as long as I'm on the record with you, Ray. And that is that I have mischaracterized a passage in a Jeffrey Goldberg interview of Barack Obama in the past by saying that they don't even pretend for a minute to mention the humanitarian crises of the poor people of Syria. That's actually not true. They both actually invoke the most pro forma, don't mean it, dispense with it type tropes about the poor people of Syria. And then they go, it makes the point even better, really. They go on and on and on about, wouldn't overthrowing Assad be a great way to weaken Iran's position in the region, Mr. President? And Barack Obama says, that's right, Jeffrey Goldberg. I'm the Israel lobby's humble servant. Look at what a great job I'm doing weakening your friend Assad in Syria. And this may be a little bit broken record from interviews with you in the past and other interviews on the show recently, but hey, it's still the most important thing in the world other than our relationship with Russia, I guess, and that is American support for these jihadis when they're the only legitimate enemies of the American people on the planet, and only because Iran is the pseudo-pretenda enemy of Israel and is actually no threat to Israel, not any more than they were when Israel was helping Ronald Reagan sell them tow missiles in the 1980s. And so, like Michael Oren puts it, well, you know, I prefer these bad guys, meaning Al-Qaeda, to Assad or Hezbollah, because they're backed by Iran. And so when he says, that's what I prefer, we see the result of that. That's what American foreign policy prefers. And then, so the fact that Obama's really pursuing this nuclear deal, well, I don't know how, you know, Gareth Porter takes it with a grain of salt, so I don't give him much more credit than that, I guess. But it seems like Obama, on one level, is trying to pursue a real nuclear deal with Iran, the last big fake outstanding issue between our two countries. But on the other hand, he continues to completely act a fool in this this Syria policy that, to hear the president himself tell it, is all just about making Israel feel good about Iran for a little while.
Well, the Iran factor is crucial. And, you know, Iran having a defense treaty with Syria, I mean, that means a lot. And the neocons thought if they could give Syria a really bloody nose, that this would at least embarrass the Iranians. But, you know, Scott, what most people don't realize is how the situation evolved. Starting exactly at this time last year, in a word, Bashar al-Assad started to win, okay? He started to win big. He was dislodging the rebels from strongholds that had held for 2 years. It looked like he might be able to consolidate his rule in all but some of the parts in the north there where looked pretty hopeless for Bashar al-Assad, but he was winning. Now, what does that mean to the Israelis? Well, Jody Ruderin, who is the New York Times bureau chief in Jerusalem, she actually reported back at that time that she had asked high-level Israeli officials, well, what's your preferred outcome in Israel? And one of them said, oh, that's easy, no outcome. And she said, wait a second, preferred outcome? No. He said, oh, yeah, no outcome. Look, it's sort of like a playoff game where you don't want either team to win. The Sunni and Shia are going at it big time in Syria, and not only Syria, the rest of that part of the world. Let the bloodletting, let the hemorrhaging continue, because as long as it continues, we in Israel consider ourselves immensely safer. Now, that, even Judy Ruderin suggested, is how the Israelis were looking at it. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that if Bashar al-Assad starts to win, that's not so good for the Israelis. And so what do they need? The ace in the hole, U.S. military involvement directly. And that's what John Kerry and Netanyahu were talking about, all of these trips that Kerry was making out there. It wasn't the Palestinians. It wasn't Iran. It was about how they're going to give Syria a really bad, bad, bloody nose. And why? Well, because Bashar al-Assad looked like he was going to win. So what happened was they wanted to mousetrap us in using this red line thing that somebody ill-advised the president to adopt. You make sure that there's a chemical attack. Actually, make sure that there are UN inspectors in Damascus just a couple of days before the chemical attack. Blame it on Bashar al-Assad. Get the U.S. involved militarily. And then you've got a Sunni and Shia at it for about 3 more years, no problem. The U.S. is not going to make possible an outcome like no outcome. We prefer no outcome. The U.S. is just going to do our bidding. That was the name of the game. That's why they wanted to mousetrap us in. Now, thankfully, and that's why I wanted to cite Martin Dempsey, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He and some of my former colleagues who had the guts to speak up said, no, Mr. President, we're not going to play Iraq again. The evidence that it was Bashar al-Assad is phony. And, of course, 2-3 months later, we have Cy Hirsch, the premier investigative reporter in this country, unable to publish this story in The New Yorker, for which he writes, or any other U.S. publication, but in the London Review of Books, giving chapter and verse as to how this went down. And how it went down was that the rebels had the sarin, the Turks helped them, the Saudis helped them, other encouragers helped them, and it was all, it almost worked. It was one day away from working, because after John Kerry made that speech on the 30th of August, the Israelis were warned, within 48 hours, we're going to get an attack, so put up your defenses. The French were told, and the French had their fighter bombers on the tarmac, okay? And it was a little embarrassing, but the White House had called both Israel and France and say, well, we changed our mind. There's not going to be an attack. That's how close we were. So to his credit, Obama was listening to a general with a conscience and with some smarts, namely Dempsey. And I see great hope in that, because I think Dempsey and other more reasonable people will realize that the neocons have led Obama down the garden path again. And even though Obama seems to be in accord with what they want, he showed himself able to act independently of them on Syria. This gives me some modest hope that he'll be able to avoid the worst on Ukraine.
Yeah. All right. Now, if you still have time, do you still have time?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great, because I'd like to get back to Ukraine in a minute. But while we're still on Syria here, There was a statement, and I think I'm on the record as being against paying Assad to torture al-Qaeda, as well as being against outright backing al-Qaeda against Assad or any kind of intervention in Syria. So I don't want anybody to misunderstand or anything like that, any kind of position I'm taking here. I saw where, I'm sorry, Ray, I don't have it in front of me. I don't know the exact phrase, but Leslie Gelb, who is kind of the evil twin doppelganger of Daniel Ellsberg, who helped him write the Pentagon Papers, but, you know, gave in to be a servant of Sauron ever since, where Daniel Ellsberg went rogue and hero on us. He was, you know, former president of the Council on Foreign Relations and all these things. He was highlighting this statement that Obama made in the West Point speech, the most recent one, not the one announcing the surge back in 2009, the most recent one here, where he was indicating that maybe he was going to start calling the war in Syria no longer an attempt to help the so-called rebels against the tyranny, but maybe it would become a counterterrorism mission, a drone mission, a special forces mission, with the implied target then being the guys that we've been backing and now are ready to betray the Jabhat al-Nusra, the ISIS, and the whatever so-called Free Syrian Army, Northern Storm and Al-Farouk Brigade and whatever kooks of non-moderates that the CIA has been arming and funding this whole time and coordinating the Saudi and Qatari and all of that, you know, and Turkish and Jordanian intervention on their behalf as well this whole time. So I wonder what you think of that. Is it possible that this Obama guy, who after all you just finished saying about how he listened to the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff tell him not to do a war and he didn't do the war, back when he could have made his current policy so much worse, as Dennis Kucinich called it at the time, acting as al-Qaeda's air force. Well, is it possible he's now going to start acting as Bashar al-Assad's air force against al-Qaeda, do you think?
I think that would be overstating the case. It's one of these deals where you don't want anyone to win in the playoffs. And to the degree that that Kerry is and Les Gelb and the likes are running this thing, you may have sounds coming out like this, but on the other hand, you have Susan Rice saying now we're giving lethal military aid to the rebels and so on. So it's an incredibly complicated set of factors.
It's really hard to decipher what Obama wants to do here or whether he's even his own agent. He seems conflicted, and he's getting conflicted advice. There are people that want the carnage to continue. And those, of course, are the people that make the weapons of carnage, the people who see benefit in keeping the pot boiling in the Middle East, and the people who see that this might actually lead to even more weapon sales in Europe and elsewhere. And then there's the tension between people like Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff Dempsey, who realizes that our military is far, far more extended than it should be, that we're not capable of. What would we do, for example, if the Chinese started to take over those islands in the South China Sea and Japan said, no, those are our islands, and we have a mutual defense treaty with the United States. We invoke that treaty right now. What would happen? Well, the U.S. would look crazy. The U.S. would look very weak because all we'd be able to do is say, well, yeah, we have that agreement, but let's be nice. Let's play nice in the South China Sea because we have other equities here. We can't keep track of them all. We got Syria, we got Ukraine, we got, you know, it's too much. Well, Obama, I don't think, is able to handle it. He may be able to make a decision and chew gum at the same time, but not more than one decision. He's being led by the nose here. Whether Les Gelb is hinting at something that is real or not, I just don't know. But right now, it's sort of ad hoc policymaking, and that makes no sense at all, except for the fact that if you're ad hocing, well, you can always change your mind, and maybe there's some benefit in that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just for his own personal selfish reasons, which are the best incentives I could possibly hope for, Barack Obama has got to not want to go down in history as the president who really... I mean, I guess it's somewhat arguable about how much power the al-Qaeda guys really, you know, have gained in Libya. But what's this project that's been going on in Syria here, this is going to look really, really bad if he just leaves it this way. And I'm not saying I want him to go to war against al-Qaeda there, but I want him to just knock it off. But going down in history as the guy that backed ISIS and al-Nusra in their suicide bomber, crucify people in the town square, prisoner beheader type of a war against a secular former sock puppet of America's. Again, you know, or not really again, but kind of same result came out of the Iraq war. And he's got to not want that to be his legacy, the way Iraq will be George W. Bush's no matter what forever, you know?
Well, I agree, Scott.
And at least he knows how to rub a couple of neurons together compared to George W. Bush. Not that he's a good man, but at least he's capable of some critical thinking skills, you know?
Yeah, I mean, comparisons are invidious, especially that one. But, you know, on the other side, he seems to be a very impressionable person. And he's impressed by the responsibility to protect tough Amazon women, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Victoria Nuland. What do they know? What do they know about military operations or the geographic and strategic equities that they're fooling around with? They're playing with fire, and yet you have Obama somewhat captive to them. And, you know, he is a wuss. I've been saying for 5 years, but you would think by now he would have some sort of discernment with respect to whom he should listen to and whom not, but that seems to be lacking. And the Ukrainian thing is one egregious example of that. Putin has offered him all kinds of ways out, but it would have required Obama standing up to the neocons, talking with Putin, working out some sort of arrangement with the EU and with the Ukrainians. Instead of that, he's stoking the fires with this new guy. And the new guy is saying very fiery things. Worst of all, the new fellow, Poroshenko, is not calling off the attacks on the folks in eastern Ukraine. And that's what worries me most, because there comes a point where, you know, Putin has his own internal people that feel very strongly about protecting Russians and protecting Russian interests. Right. I still don't believe it's likely that Putin's going to send Russian forces into that part of the Ukraine, but he has other weapons. He has he has economic leverage that won't quit. So I just hope that the carnage out there, and it's less than it is in Syria, as far as I can tell, will eventually die down when Poroshenko is finally told by the United States and others, look, it's time to make a deal. We overplayed our hand. We're not going to get Ukraine into NATO or even into the EU. Let's cool it for a while and let's sit around a table, take everybody's interests into account, have a federated sort of thing like Finland. Incidentally, do you know who's in Finland today? The Soviet foreign minister, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. Now, that's really interesting. Finland is the paragon of a country that can live in Russia's shadow and survive and flourish as long as it doesn't join any military alliance aimed at Russia, and as long as it keeps a decent respect for Russian national interests.
All right, but Ray, what game is the President of the United States playing here? Because you know what? I'll even go with the Robert Perry thesis that the Kagans here, they're just getting out of hand, out from under Obama. They created this crisis. Let's pretend Obama had no idea what was going on there with the Orange Revolution 2 in February, whatever. Now he's in this mess, and he is not ordering his government to order this Poroshenko guy to call it off, sit down, talk nice, make a deal. He keeps pushing and pushing this. He's now acceding to the hawks and saying, okay, more military-type equipment. I don't know exactly what all he's giving them, but hell, I might as well assume the worst, Ray. They are looking at a government in Kiev that is too weak to enforce its reign on the east, and so they're arming it up so that it'll be strong enough to have a real civil war here and to push this thing. And they're not doing the opposite of that. I mean, you're making the great case for what's the obvious thing to do here now, but Obama is not listening to you, man. He keeps going with this thing. Otherwise, as you say, this, you know, tough talk and tough actions in the east, we just talked with Dan McAdams about the people killed and the airstrikes and all of that over there, covered up in the media here. That's just making matters worse and could lead, like you're saying, could lead to a real Russian invasion of the East. And then, oh my God, you know, that'll be the first day in history. Oh no, Russia marches west. And, you know, a whole new Cold War times 10 then, in today's climate. So, what the hell does Obama, what do you think Obama thinks he's doing over there at this point? Never mind what Victoria Nuland wants. It's not up to her.
Well, that's the $64 question, Scott. I don't know if Obama knows what he wants. I know he's under a lot of conflicting pressures. And, you know, his dilemma is really how he reads Putin and how Putin looks at things. Now, you know, if you look at what's happening from Putin's point of view, you have B-52s and stealth bombers now deployed to Europe, okay? Now, that's a totally unnecessary thing. The Russians are not threatening Europe, and yet Obama has let himself be persuaded to send stealth bombers from interestingly named White Man Air Force Base in Missouri, which I was at a month or so ago, and the B-52s. Now, why would he want to do that? Well, that betokens a guy who wants to show how tough he is, but Putin can't just sort of say, well, he's just, you know, just trying to appear tough. He's got to reckon with the hardware, okay? And stealth bombers and B-52s are an act of provocation that he has to take into account. The other thing, and what people don't really realize, is that when Putin made that long, his 4 hours, his press conference on April 17th, he was asked a lot of questions. And one of the things he said was, you know, the idea of trying to draw Ukraine into NATO, that's bad enough. But even worse is this missile defense system that they're trying to emplace in Poland, in the Czech Republic, and worse still, on warships in the Black Sea and elsewhere, okay? That's what bothers us even more. Now, if you're Putin and you're looking on and you see the President of the United States not only developing this anti-missile system ostensibly aimed at non-existent yet Iranian nuclear-tipped missiles, and you see that it's really aimed to permit the United States to have a first strike, well, that gives you the idea, from Putin's point of view, that this guy, whether he feels, however he feels, he's a wuss. And he looks like he's a tool of the, what we call the military-industrial complex. I've run into, he says, I know what that's like, Khrushchev ran into that too. Obama doesn't seem to be able to act in any way like John Kennedy. And so I have to take that into account. That's what makes this situation explosive. Because as Putin himself has said, words are cheap. Actions really matter. And what he watches Poroshenko do at the diktat of the U.S. and the EU is what the operable factor will be. I just hope that Obama will come to his senses, listen to people like Jack Matlock, the previous ambassador to the Soviet Union and Russia, and cool it. And just say, look, let's cool it here, and that Poroshenko will take his advice and you know, do what he says he wants. He wants a ceasefire. Well, it's in his power now to cause a ceasefire. Let him do it. If he doesn't do it, well, we can read the situation for what it is, not for what it rhetorically is supposed to be.
Right. Well, I mean, and this is the problem with all this stuff is how obvious the counterfactual is, how obvious it is what the right thing to do would be. And, you know, and then they do nothing but the opposite of that. And so you had tweeted out this morning, or I don't know where the hell I saw this. You put it somewhere here, this statement of Bill Bradley. Oh, I guess I found it on your... Oh, no, you emailed it to me. This statement of Bill Bradley, a former Democratic senator, former presidential... attempted nominee, ran against Al Gore in the primaries back in 2000 for the Democratic nomination. And Here he's giving a very sober talk for about 10 minutes to the Carnegie Endowment. So it's an audience of all kind of yes men on the inside of the establishment, kind of people in the crowd. And so he's basically up there on the premise that, like, hey, guys, I'm going to talk to you candidly a little bit here about maybe another point of view on Russia that you might need to hear or something. And what really bothers me in this is you can tell that he's telling them what he thinks they need to know, but that he also knows that they don't know. This is a crowd of people who believe their own nonsense about what they're claiming about Russia and their motivations and what's really going on here. And then he tells the same story as you and Jack Matlock and the rest about how we got into this mess. And it was the expansion of NATO, when we should have been treating the Russians as a beaten friend, you know, with sportsmanship, you know, beaten ex-enemy that now we can be friends with. We just kept kicking them while they're down over and over and over again, and now it's come to this. We've got a real border dispute that, you know, I'm trying to remember who it was and whether we talked about this in the recent past, Ray, but there was a story that was written, I think, for Forbes or something about how a real war in Ukraine, like if the Russians invaded and, you know, the Ukrainian army, you know, did their very best against them, the Americans got pulled in or other European forces got pulled into a real war in Ukraine, which is possible, even if they're not NATO members, that could very quickly lead to nuclear weapons, the use of nuclear weapons. He said it's a mistake for people to think of nuclear war as this whole other different separate kind of war where, you know, you imagine missile silos in North Dakota and Montana, you know, being turned and full-scale intercontinental ballistic missiles taking out capital cities and all these kinds of full-scale things. But he's saying that, no, really, it's one continuum. It's not a whole different kind of war. And if the Americans were really losing on the battlefield to the Russians in Eastern Europe, they might use nukes to preserve the credibility of NATO, which they see as the single highest priority on the face of the planet. And the Russians, they just might use nukes if they thought that they were really going to be faced with NATO nukes stationed in Ukraine. That would be absolutely intolerable of a situation for them to be faced with if they were beaten with chemical weapons to that point, or conventional weapons, I mean, to that point, and that they then could use tactical, you know, battlefield nuclear weapons, and that even in that entire scenario, the commanders would have to be able to have the permission and have the nukes to deploy in order for them to be useful. And so at that point, you're not even talking about the president giving a command to the guys in Montana. You're talking about people on the battlefield, maybe generals from other countries' militaries in charge of using America's nuclear weapons, and God knows who in Russia in charge of using theirs. And this is, they're really messing with complete and total danger. Not to be that alarmist, because I'm not the kind of guy who really believes that it's always the worst case scenario, but damned if it don't look like the Americans are trying to turn this thing into some kind of worst case scenario here, when all they have to do, like you say, is say, ahem, we're all going to sit down at a table and start meeting now. America's the 9 zillion pound gorilla here and can force all sides to the table just at their suggestion, and yet they just won't do it. And I'm sorry for going on so long, but it sort of seems like, to try to set the context here, like you're saying, like Eric Margulies as well, is comparing this to the start of World War One. This is a setup for a real big set of blunders that could go very, very wrong.
Well, that's right. You know, the Guns of August really started around now, back in 1914. And, you know, the equities here are incredible. When John Kerry was asked, are you aware, Mr. Secretary, that this could lead to war with a nuclear power? Kerry said, yes, we're aware of that. We've taken that into account, period. Now, you're Putin, or you're the chairman of the equivalent Joint Chiefs of Staff in Moscow, right? And you're listening to this and say, is this guy detached from reality? And if he is detached from reality, and if he totally eclipses his colleague Hagel there as defense secretary, what does that mean to us? How should we protect ourselves from this kind of, well, I won't say the word that comes first to mind. Now, that's important, because declaratory policy has always been just as important as moving troops around. If you have a Secretary of State says, yeah, we're willing that this, we acknowledge, we're aware
that this could lead to a conflict with a nuclear rival. So that's number one. Number two, what do Samantha Power, or Susan Rice, or Victoria Nuland know about strategic defense or strategic offense? They know nothing. And yet they seem to be in the catbird seat there in the White House. Obama seems to be listening to them more these most recent days than he is to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey. What does that mean? Well, if I were Russian and I was looking on at this, it wouldn't require me to watch forward deployed nuclear weapons. Of course, these stealth bombers and B-52s can carry that ordnance. It would suffice for me to see a defensive attempt to shift the strategic equilibrium here. And what I'm talking about is missile defense. Now, Bobby Gates brags about the fact that when he saw there were a lot of Poles and a lot of Czechs that didn't want to be targets of Soviet retaliation if missile defense systems were put in their countries, he says, I got an idea. Let's put them on ships, okay? Whoa, great idea, Bobby. And we can sail those ships where? Well, the Treaty of Montreux allows us to sail these ships right through the Bosphorus, right into the Black Sea, right? So if I'm Putin and I'm looking at John Kerry, I'm looking at this sort of nonchalant adherence to putting in a missile defense and putting it on ships, now, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to seize the Crimea before anybody takes a second look at it. Because as Putin himself said in one of those long interviews, the notion of Ukraine joining NATO and, Sevastopol, our naval base since Catherine the Great, for us to have to visit U.S. and other NATO sailors in Sevastopol, I really would much rather it be like it is now, where if they want to come to Sevastopol, I'd really prefer that they would be visiting our base and our sailors. Now, that was sort of a jocular way of putting it, but there it goes. You put missile defense ships in the Black Sea, you've changed the strategic equation, and no knowledgeable or no conscientious Russian or other leader of any country will put his nation in such jeopardy when he has the high cards and can prevent it. And so there you have the lesson of Crimea. Crimea was ripe for plucking. He plucked it, and there's a lot more story to that. But the important point I'd like to make here is that as Putin looks on, and this is what we have to do, if we look through the Russian point of view, he sees nothing but fecklessness at best and serious desires to assert control over that part of the world at worst. And he doesn't know where Obama comes out. That's why they really need to get together for more than 15 minutes. Putin needs to read the riot act to Obama, saying, look, you can't come and make nice with me privately and then excoriate me publicly just for political benefit. You said to Medvedev 6 or 7 years ago, you said to Medvedev before the last election, you said, look, missile defense, look, just give me some slack. Give me some time. I'm going to get reelected. When I get reelected, then we'll talk about my missile defense. Well, what happened to that? What happened to that, Obama? So what needs to happen is these guys have to be able to understand each other better. I had hoped that something might happen in connection with Normandy. I can see Putin and the Russians coming away from Normandy in high dudgeon. I mean, all this business about, I saw one article today that the Russians should have been invited, right? It was the Russians that won that damn war. It was the Russians that at Stalingrad turned back the Nazi hordes and at Kursk obliterated the Nazi tanks. It was the Russians that fought from 1941 to June 6, 1944, virtually alone. Sure, there was some activity in the Mediterranean and Italy and places like that, but they bore the brunt. They lost 25 million people, and how did they get treated at Normandy? As sort of the second cousin, and with pundits writing, they shouldn't have even been invited. Well, history has some significance.
Nationalism, good or bad, has some historic influence on decisions. And I just marvel, and I'll say this right on the record, I just marvel at how much sang-froid, how much restraint Obama and Lavrov and the others, the real pros in the Russian diplomatic service, have exercised under what most reasonable people would say have been extreme provocation by the likes of John Kerry.
Yep. All right. Well, you know, I think we better leave it here, Ray, so it's not just too long for anybody to hear. But it sure has been a good one. I sure appreciate your insight on all these very important issues. I hope that we don't get H-bombed to death before we have a chance to do it again.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Scott.
Appreciate it. Everybody, that is the heroic Ray McGovern. He's at raymcgovern.com, at consortiumnews.com, and at original.antiwar.com. His piece today, or from yesterday, actually, for the anniversary, is Leaving the USS Liberty Crew Behind. But especially, he's been writing a lot of great stuff about Ukraine and Syria lately as well. You can find it all at antiwar.com and at consortiumnews.com. All right, thanks. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These PNAC clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page.